Hello, friends, and welcome to the Healing Ground Movement. Now, for more content and bonus features, you can join us on Facebook and Instagram. And remember, all of our content is delivered freely, so please consider supporting the show by donating via the link on our website at healinggroundmovement.com or liking and reviewing the podcast on your favorite platform.
Enjoy today's episode.
Today's episode is brought to you by one of my all-time favorite apps, Blinkist. I found out about this app when I was pregnant and didn't have as much time to read, particularly into those early years of mothering, and it has been a game changer. Blinkist brings you knowledge from top nonfiction and podcasts so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and the best part is it condenses it down into 15 minutes. You can either listen or read to key ideas from best-selling nonfiction in just 15 minutes. So you keep getting all of these great recommendations, all the parenting books, all the health books, all of the things that you know you should be doing and know that you should know more about, but you just don't have the time to read the full version. You can get the Cliff Notes version from Blinkist. They have teamed up with podcast creators to bring you key insights from podcasts as well. And there is expert curation, their handpicked recommendation tailored to what you're interested in. So the more you listen, the more specific your recommendations get. Visit healinggroundmovement.com/resources for a free trial of Blinkist. I know you're going to love it as much as I do. Enjoy today's episode. Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Healing Ground Movement Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, and today we are going to take an interesting deep dive into a very unique and special part of our body there, right into our throat and swallowing and all the tissues that are part of that. But our guest today, Walt Fritz, is so much more than just a specialist in the in manual therapy of voice and swallowing. He teaches a patient person-centered model of manual therapy to health and voice pedagogy professionals throughout his foundations and manual therapy seminars. While he works and teaches from a recognizable myofascial release style of manual therapy, he's embraced current practice understanding of pain and dysfunction and the factors that influence them and evolve the work into a more centrist model. He teaches throughout the US and internationally to so many different professions and voice clinicians. So, Walt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks. It's almost like I wrote that myself, that little intro there.
I think you did.
I think I did. Yeah. Thanks for having me, Carly. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Well, I have loved chatting with you a little bit as we get to know each other before the recording, but I think our listeners should also get an opportunity to hear how you arrive at such an interesting niche of care, as well as how that niche sort of explodes out to a more holistic approach to the body.
Yeah.
Tell us where you began.
Well, first of all, let me start where I'm at now, because while my love is this voice and swallowing disorders work that I do and use and teach, I still teach to a broader audience of, you know, where I came from, that physical therapy background, that massage therapy background, in terms of teaching them more of that whole body approach. And I still do that work in my practice here, my physical therapy practice in upstate New York, but I still teach to that community as well. But it's like I'm getting old, and I feel like I'm just starting again with this whole going down a rabbit hole of a patient-centered care model of care for voice and swallowing disorders. It's really become an interesting piece of who I am. So briefly, physical therapist, and as we just talked about before we were online, when you asked me, do I have a master's or a doctor? And I said, neither. I graduated from PT school back in 85 before there was even a master's in physical therapy created in the United States. And unlike a lot of my colleagues who chose to go back for, you know, either a master's or a doctorate, I got complacent and I worked and I didn't care much about education. I didn't care much about the evidence. When I graduated, the evidence-based model hadn't really been integrated into the physical therapy world yet. So I kind of bypassed all that and kind of skated for a while. Okay. And I got into, I worked in a lot of different settings, home care, pediatrics, developmental disabilities, general, all sorts of things. I got into the myofascial release model in 1992, which really captured my interest. It was sort of counter evidence-based model. It was, it really was. It was about, oh, you know, evidence doesn't matter. Our outcomes matter. And you know what? I don't think those two have to be mutually exclusive. I kind of went down headfirst into the rabbit hole of myofascial release, and I enjoyed the heck out of it. I used it in my home care practice, in my pediatric practice, and eventually in my private practice. I was an assistant, teaching assistant for, you know, one of the big models of myofascial release in the United States, and for about 10 years. And I learned a lot from that. In hindsight, I learned a lot of how to engage people, how to use my hands, how to start a verbal and nonverbal communication using touch. I learned a lot about the secrets of the fascia that in hindsight, you know, were kind of, I had blinders on. Seeing the world as every problem being fascial based is just as wrong as seeing the world from any one perspective. And It took me a long time to emerge from that rabbit hole. But I finally did in kind of the mid 2000s and broke off on my own, started a real slow end of a kind of a continuing education seminar that took a while to build. And it really, it wasn't until 2013 when I got invited to teach a one-of class in Chicago by a speech pathologist out of the University of Chicago Voice Care Center, who invited me, a practitioner, as well as an ENT surgeon and researcher from New York City, to come and do a workshop. And that was a real eye-opener for me, working, teaching to speech pathologists. And I just thought it was just I thought it bombed. It was horrible. It was just so bad. You know, the reason being is I didn't know I didn't know my market. I didn't know my audience well enough, but I had no way of knowing my audience well enough. I just taught, I sort of inserted things like voice and swallowing into the things I was already doing and teaching. But over the course of the next couple of years from 2013 and on, a couple of speech pathologists in the United States mentored me in helping me build both a class and eventually a brand to be more relevant to the speech pathologist, to the voice professional, and to physical therapies, chiropractors, massage therapists, osteopaths, who were more focusing on anterior neck work, whether it's for voice and swallowing issues, globus, breathing, facial issues, that sort of thing. It's taken off since then. And I teach now, probably 90% of my classes are that voice and swallowing disorders class, which is, you know, it's got me a book deal that I'm just finishing up. It's got me a master's I'm working on to try and put this whole concept that I use, the way that I teach, the way to present it into an academic framework, not just about what we think we're doing to the tissues, but how we're impacting our patients' brain and central nervous system, and how to incorporate them into the model and the process a lot more than I learned in all of my manual therapy background, you know, because it was all about me being the expert. I was the fascial expert. I was a master, quote unquote. And so much so that the higher I went up that food chain of being an expert, the less I thought that my patient had a significant role to play in this process. And to the point where they sort of deferred to me. It's like, well, I don't know what's going on. You tell me, you're the expert, right? Mm-hmm. And I was more than willing to tell them all the crap that was wrong with their fascia and their emotions stuck in their fascia and all that stuff. And you know what? It helped. It worked. It really did. But as I broke free from that model and realized there's a lot of people talking about a lot of different stories out there, are there common denominators to all these stories? Instead of it being the joint or the fascia or the trigger point or whatever, are there common denominators? And I think the therapeutic relationship that we build with a patient is probably the great unspoken one, the one that's really hard to sell a book on and continue an ed on. But I really think that model of shared decision-making and the relationship we build is truly the most pivotal aspect of the work that maybe you and I and the rest of your listeners might be doing or receiving, depending on if they're patients.
Absolutely. Oh, you bring up so many fascinating dichotomies throughout your experience, throughout your training and your approach to care. We're gonna pick them up and dissect them apart throughout our conversation. But I think you're right. And we talk about it, and at least in one field of care, in psychological therapy, there has been enough evidence to suggest, to prove that the modality of care in psychology matters not at all, really, when it comes down to it. It's the relationship that you have with the therapist, the trust that you put in the therapist. Right. And to my knowledge, there isn't that research in chiropractic and massage and fascia and OT and all that, but
There's a wee bit. Anyway, I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, please. I brought that up to say, like, tell me if I've missed it, to say that I bet it's still true.
I would love to share, and we don't have to do it here, but I can share with you a massage paper where they did general global relaxation massage as on one arm, and the other arm is specific medical clinical massage for low back pain. And they found 6 months outcomes were equal, which, you know, that really ticks a lot of medical massage therapists off, because the specificity that we think we own and we're sold and we sell seems to make us somehow better able to care for that person with low back pain. Mm-hmm. But the 6 month outcomes are no different. There's a couple of papers in the manual circumlaryngeal work, which is a specific time of laryngeal manipulation for voice disorders, which shows that the model mattered less than the fact that we're doing something, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's another common denominator.
Yeah. And just to take, I mean, there's nothing new under the sun. And the more conversations I have, the more the theme comes down to do something. I don't want to oversimplify for our listeners, but to do something. And we kind of joked in my chiropractic training, another expert level of doctorate training, that really all we learned in, not all, I really hope our listeners know that there's a lot of tongue in cheek in my comments, but that all we learned was just how not to hurt people.
Yeah.
And I think that really becomes the foundation of a lot of these types of training, is how not to cause more harm. You know, Hippocratic, first do no harm. And then after that, the fact that we're doing something, the fact that we are relaying compassionately with a client or a patient, and why so much stock is put in that bedside manner, that ephemeral, unmeasurable, I just like them, it really is such a huge impact on our care.
Yeah. Two things. You said, you know, sometimes that what we do doesn't matter, except how we sound when we talk about what we do. I think that matters, right? I can't just walk into a room and say, I don't know what's wrong with you, and I don't know what I should do, so I'm just going to touch you. That's not going to work. They're not going to pay us. The recipes that we learn from all of these different models. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so funny, because I was taught a model where everybody needs to retake classes so you learn to be a more skilled clinician. I think the value of retaking a class is that you're better able to recite the recipe and the script. Mm-hmm. And so you can then, you move from the elevator speech to sounding knowledgeable about fascia work or whatever it is. And I think that's part of patient expectations, is they expect us to be able to speak smartly about what we're doing. And, you know, that's a contextual factor, but it really matters. I wrote a blog post a while back called Anatomy Matters, But Which Anatomy? Does anatomy matter as much as you and I were taught and our patients think? And it may not matter from the things that I'm doing to them, mm-hmm. but it may matter to them that I know my anatomy, right? So there's a really weird reversal.
It's not the what you know, it's the how you know it kind of idea, but that gets into a really weird feed forward, feed backward, chicken and egg kind of conversation.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about doing no harm, I would love to put this out there. Mm-hmm. Do no harm in terms of physical harm, but what about I speak rather cynically and sarcastically, so you're going to have to bear with me. What about the indoctrination that I used to do to the patients who walked into my office not knowing anything about fascia? And I was indoctrinating them on fascia being the unknown tissue, fascia being the unknown problem, because nobody else does it, the work that I do. And is there harm in telling them almost what they're asking for? right? Mm-hmm. I kind of wonder, and I've not seen any evidence on that in terms of how my words to them impact possibly almost acting in a nocebo fashion, right?
Yes, and yeah. We had a conversation. The name of the doctor is escaping me. Oh, Dr. Nick Studholm, for any of our listeners that want to go back into the archives. But I believe it was with Nick. If I'm wrong, we will put a clarifying note in here. Okay. I'm going to say with Dr. Studholm, I hope I'm giving correct credit. But we talked about that nocebo effect. And we talked about the idea that if you are telling a patient, if you're telling a client that you have a tight whatever, this is how you are and will be unless you come see me. This is putting the idea in their head. And this is a negative feed forward of, I will always have this problem. And I see this often in my office with disc patients, and we call them disc patients, just right there in that word. You are categorized by your herniated disc. And even though that has healed and become a non-issue 5 years ago, they are still a disc patient.
Yeah.
Is that doing harm? And I would argue that it is. And I still have to catch myself like right here. I just did a great slip of the tongue on it that I'm trying to unlearn that practice.
Yeah. Yeah. I use a similar kind of framework when it comes to the concept of treating something in the body. Like in this voice and swallowing work, we start with the lower thoracic region. And in my earlier days of teaching this work and treating, I used to say, okay, we're going to treat the diaphragm now. Can one treat the diaphragm? And I love asking that question to a group. Can you treat the diaphragm? And then, you know, everybody senses that it's a trick question. And, you know, you'll get some nods and you'll get a lot of like, I don't want to say anything because I don't want to be wrong. And it's like, no, you can't treat the diaphragm unless you have a scalpel, right? You can treat problems that have been associated with the diaphragm. You can treat the area overlying the diaphragm. But even when we get in there with some assaultive and aggressive techniques that I learned for diaphragm work, you're still not treating the diaphragm as an isolated muscle, right? And a lot of people are like, oh, you're just picking at straws here. You're just going too deep into the semantics of it. And it's like, I think it's really important to be as honest as possible. The problem is a lot of us, and I don't want to speak for you, a lot of me's have been taught that, you can treat the diaphragm. Yeah, you can treat the vagus nerve as if somehow you could reach in and grab it. You can you can treat the hyoid when it's elevated or the larynx when it's rotated or whatever. And I just think those are ideas that it's going to take a long time to sort of unwed ourselves from that, but we need to start doing it. We can only treat the person. One of my really good mentors in this later part of my career has been a Canadian physiotherapist by the name of Diane Jacobs. And she teaches a neurodynamic approach to pain based on skin mechanics, skin anatomy, skin physiology. And it's a really interesting perspective. And, you know, she's got a line, if you will, that I'm sure you've heard it from other people. It's despite what we think we're doing inside of the body, the only thing we can be certain is we're touching skin. Can you come up with a framework to explain a model that doesn't have to rely on your basically pulling and carving away other things to get to something deeper? Can you explain your work in a way that allows the skin organ, as she talks about it, to at least be a part of it? And that's been a pivotal shift from me from that. It's all about the fascia to it's all about the skin, or even greater, it's all about the human, including their values and perspectives.
Well, and what you're speaking to in this idea of I am treating this thing, it really stems from this medical model of where we believe we are able to isolate. And it has been a false belief since the beginning, or an oversimplified belief, let's put it this way, that I am only going to treat a cardiac issue with this medication, and yet there's all these side effects, which are really just effects of the fact that we can't just treat cardiac. And so it's the same way of, I could be manipulating, and to use old framework language, I could be manipulating the hyoid, but really all I'm doing is manipulating the tissue on the front of the neck. And somewhere around it, that system is being impacted where it's going to impact the hyoid, we sure hope. Yeah. And for those of our listeners who don't know, the hyoid is actually this horseshoe-shaped bone that floats amongst much tissue and attachment right at the very center of the front of your neck and can impact our voice box and our breathing and all kinds of stuff. So there's your crash course on the hyoid right there. Way too simplified. But, you know, we're not actually just treating the hyoid any more than just treating the heart. Just. It is, right. We are just treating the system and hope we have the outcome we're looking for.
Yeah. And unfortunately, our education system and our continuing education system continues to sort of, okay, now we're going to work on, you know, we're going to work on fascia, we're going to work on muscle, we're going to work on joints and bones, whatever, as if somehow you can do that. A line that I like to use in every one of my classes is for those of you who think you can selectively treat, for instance, a trigger point, as if somehow, first of all, that it actually exists is that little black thing in the book. But if you think that the only thing you're affecting is the trigger point, if your patient is feeling you touch them, you've immediately doubled the possibilities of what's being impacted, because their ability to feel goes right up to the brain and starts them involved in the process, versus this selection of tissues like you and I and most of the rest of us have been taught, which is really a shame. We've really forgotten about the person that we're working with, and we're viewing them as a bunch of tissues that are, you know, they're there for our selection.
Mm-hmm. Well, and my brain just goes so many different directions here. But where I think I might go with this is another dichotomy that you brought up that I think sort of fits in right here. And you kind of glanced over it, but I think it's a really important thing to talk about, which is evidence-based versus outcome-based approach to care. And I think it could be easy to say that you were, you know, throwing evidence-based under the bus and saying it's not important. But what I heard you say was that it is not the important thing. How is evidence-based and outcome-based not actually mutually exclusive? How do you see those two dancing together instead of fighting with each other?
Well, if we really, you know, pay attention to the evidence, that actually might increase our efficacy. You know, there's a problem to me with the evidence-based model in that it relies so strongly on randomized controlled trials, which is basically a large pool of people who kind of resemble each other, right? You single out or you weed out patients who have a lot of comorbidities that can confound the outcomes in a study, right? Mm-hmm. And all of this is very familiar to you. If you're doing let's pretend you're seeing a patient for a respiratory problem, right? And you look to a study and you say, okay, in this study, let's pretend I'm a physician. They tested this medicine with this problem and it helped, but they had to weed out the smokers. They had to weed out the people with COPD. They had to weed out all these people. And then they tried the medicine and it was helpful for this problem. Great. That then becomes an evidence-based intervention for that physician to prescribe a medication. But then in comes Mr. Smoker, right? And it's like, okay, he fits every criteria that study says this medicine should help for. But he smokes, right? How do you deal with that from an evidence-based perspective? And that's one of the problems that faces the evidence-based model. There's a really cool thing going on in Norway right now, trying to move it to the complexity of the individual. It's called the Cause Health Project, but we can talk about that later if you want. But to me, looking at the evidence doesn't preclude that I can't still be effective in doing that. In fact, one of the problems with my myofascial release model, there wasn't a lot of evidence to support it. So I kind of think that it was basically an excuse. People are happy with what we do, their pain goes away or whatever. It's like, who needs evidence? Like, well, if you can't provide a viable mechanism of action for your intervention, maybe you need to work harder. Outcome-based studies are lovely, but they don't really prove what's happening, right? Mm-hmm. And you and I work from outcome-based perspective. That's evidence. And that can improve your outcomes by using some of those. But what's missing in so many manual therapies are true multifactorial mechanism of action studies that look at not just the tissue, but the person, their central nervous system, autonomics, context, all of those things. And there's some really cool papers that have come out in the last 10 years that talk about that multifactorial explanation for mechanism of action. And I personally think that my outcomes have gotten better since I've understood the broadness of the evidence better and the limitations of the evidence that I use to support my work.
And it's sort of looking at, you know, what we've been studied and what has been studied and what could possibly be studied.
Yeah,
because when you only have the evidence that takes into account one system, one impact, one very the strict subset of people, then you only have that. But as we start to get more advanced and start to broaden our horizon evidence and say that this isn't just a skin change. We are affecting pressure sensors, which affect how fascia moves and how fascia moves affects fluid dynamics, which affects, I mean, we are all part of this larger system and we can't narrow it down so much. That's how we get the ghost in the machine. That's how we get these unknowns, which really I think is a hubris of saying we just didn't look broadly enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, when you go into an RCT or a lot of the traditional evidence, they're narrowing it so much that it's really hard to see the forest for the trees. But you know, that's the nature. Can you then take that and can you broaden it? I love to quote two studies. One was by Cohen in 2008. One was by Kendall in 2018 that talk about being faithful to the evidence. But allowing flexibility within it, okay? That no one takes a study, well, I don't want to say nobody, few people take a study and say, okay, let's look at the study. They did this thing for 5 minutes and then this thing for 5 minutes, right? In that sort of way. And then you're going to say to your patient, okay, I'm going to do this exact study. I mean, maybe in the beginning you do it like that, but then you learn to adapt it. We take 10 studies that talk about what might be good for a person's breathing. And we pick and choose based on our patient selection, as well as our own biases. I mean, we are part of that intervention. And anybody thinks they're a sort of a third-party observer, you know, the researcher as observer just doesn't exist in our world. It's the researcher as participant is what you and I are doing every day.
Oh, absolutely. And we have to hold our part in that process of healing. And we have to hold our part in all of the dynamic changes that can occur. I couldn't agree more there. So as we have now kind of done this very large umbrella about research and treatment and all the things that we're affecting, what I'd really love to dive into is some then of your specific work that you do, or not so specific work as this conversation might point to, around swallowing and speech disorders, and how you have taken this whole journey and applied it to a very specific part of the body, and yet understanding that there is a whole human behind it.
Right. It's kind of a broad question, and maybe I'll just sort of dive in. I think one of the challenges that I faced early on was there was manual therapies per se have been a part of the voice dysfunction world since about 1990, when they started doing laryngeal manipulation. Okay. What I call aggressive, not necessarily in a bad way, but aggressive manipulation and reposturing, repositioning the larynx. A high larynx is often viewed as a problem in voice and you need to get the larynx down. And they use various manipulative techniques. And then they use a really nice tapering model where they'll hold the larynx down, manipulate the muscle tension as if you can, select that locally. But then they'll hold it and then taper it away, meaning the person then speaks and they work toward a clearer voice, less hoarseness, et cetera. And then the clinician will taper their hand away, allowing the patient to sort of take over on their own, which is a lovely model. I love that aspect of that model where it's not about, you know, okay, you need to come in to see me for me to fix you. And if you have a problem, you need to come back, right? I love that concept of allowing the patient to take over. But what bothered me about receiving laryngeal manipulation and then taking some laryngeal manipulation training on my own was the aggressiveness of it, was the, that old-fashioned soft tissue manipulation where you're getting in, you're beating the crap out of digastrics or whatever, and you're making these one-sided decisions on what's wrong with the patient. And there was never any inclusion of the patient in either the evaluation or the treatment. It's basically, you know, keep yourself or keep your emotions and your beliefs and your past at the door, bring your tissues in here and I will fix that. And, you know, the evidence shows that that model worked and has worked. But what I've been doing is allowing another version of that to exist and allow if you're old enough to remember the old George Bush one saying, right? A kinder, gentler version. He was looking for a kinder, gentler world. I'm wondering if there's a kinder, gentler way that we can do some of those aggressive works with people. And that's all I do. I use that, what some might recognize as a myofascial release kind of work, with that slow, static engagement. I think what's lacking in a manipulative approach is you're basically doing things so quickly that the patient is just sort of holding on until you're done. But when we do it in, for instance, if we're doing laryngeal work and we take the thyroid cartilage and we move it to one side and we allow the patient to feel what's going on there, and then we move it to the other side and see what's going on there as well, I think that the patient's perspective is allowed to be maybe an equal part in that, because what I think is important, and I'm saying, oh, feel all that stuff, the patient may not be getting any of that in terms of a negative. If we go to the other way, the patient says, oh, now I feel that. You just exacerbated my problem, or you calm my problem in some way like that, right? So what I've done is basically taken that model and using some of the evidence for manipulative type therapies for voice and applied it into the slower, gentler version. But it's kind of a big bag of things we work with, because whether it's a speech pathologist, the voice coach, the massage therapist, the PT, the OT, the chiropractor, the osteopath who comes to a class because they either specialize with that patient population, dysfunctional or performance population, right? Or they simply had an interest in the kind of work that I teach or the approach that I take, right? We kind of work through up from the region of the diaphragm. We work a lot in the upper chest and certainly a lot in the laryngeal region, and coming in a really cool way behind the sternocleid and mastoids, getting into that space in front of the transverse processes and behind the posterior margins of the thyroid cartilage. But then moving up and working with sublingual, base of tongue work itself. And it's very satisfying work for me. I kind of stumbled into it here in my office with my neck pain patients. You know, I'd be doing something with their neck in the way that I was taught. And on their history form, they only said, I have neck pain. I have pain on my arm, whatever, right? Because I'm a PT. Why would I tell them anything else? Okay. And then here we are doing things on the table in this region. And they started to feel a broader context of what they were experiencing. And they started talking to me about, well, that's really strange, because I feel that's the problem I feel when I have trouble swallowing white meat chicken or something, right? Or a pill. I get tongue tension, and you're kind of tapping into that feeling I get at the end of a performance. So that's really what made my mind go, you know what, there's a lot of other stuff going on in here than how I originally was taught, instead of just for neck pain or arm pain or something like that.
Well, it takes us right back to that whole systems model. And even a little bit when you were at the very beginning talking about, you know, something being just a myofascial problem or just a joint problem, we need to look at all of these approaches to care from a really integrated place, whether that's, you know, a variety of approaches of a provider or a variety of approaches of what's going on in the body. It's all interconnected. I mean, you ask, I think in another trick question scenario, much like the, can we treat the diaphragm? You know, it would be asking, you know, where does singing come from in your body? Point to where the singing comes from.
Yeah.
Yeah, give me the
one would say the vocal folds, right? Where the sound is generated. So others would say the diaphragm, the chest wall, the lungs. Others would say the tongue. The tongue's really important there, but it's probably up here, right? It's probably the patient's brain and central nervous system, which is creating all of that and modulating all that, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone's right. None of them are wrong.
Yeah.
That's the cool part.
And that speaks really intimately to what inroads that provider, that patient is going to want to take too. So where you get that co-relationship between the client patient and the provider is to say, where do you feel this starts? Yeah. Is it your brain? Is it your speech? Is it your diaphragm? Is it your shoulder tension? Is it the fact that your pinky toe won't stop itching and you can't stop thinking about it? And where my bias is as the type of provider I'm training in. And can we start this journey together to then find all the places where this system has developed a hiccup and unwind them all?
Yeah. Somewhere. You know, a lot of people start from, if you don't balance the pelvis, nothing will work. Nothing will hold. Mm-hmm. If you don't get the feet level, nothing will hold. If you don't get C1 centered on that, you know, all of those models. And the weird part is the clinician finds a way to help the patient based on that recipe, right? And I was taught with, if you don't balance the pelvis enough, you always start with the pelvis, right? And if you didn't start with the pelvis, somehow their head would blow off or something like that, right? Or the results wouldn't last. So we all started with the pelvis and we all had good outcomes. But then I started looking at these other models and it's like, are they so inferior to my model? But people seem to like that person and that practice. And so what I've done is I might get to your pelvis someday. I might get to your feet or your neck, whatever, right? But what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you, Carly, where do you feel the problem lies? And I love that because sometimes patients look at me and they say, nobody ever asked me that sort of thing because I don't know anything. It's like, yeah, but you know what you're feeling. Mm-hmm. So, and I love people say, well, where do you start? You know, what technique do you start with? And I said, I let them show me where to start. If it's right here, that's where I put my hands and that's where we start to have that conversation that you're talking about, right? We're going to spread out. We're going to do other things, but it's all the while validating the patient's experience and validating them as a real valued member of this partnership.
Absolutely. A couple of stories came to mind on that. One of them was, you know, I was seeing a chiropractor for a while and his approach, his training, his Gonstead training was very much align the spine and everything else will follow. Everything else will follow. And that's not untrue. Just like the starting with the pelvis or starting with the neck or any of these things, the whole body's connected. Eventually it's going to ripple out. But I was on my way to his office at one point and I rolled my ankle. And I needed my ankle adjusted and he adjusted my pelvis because I did a number on that as well. And he said, you know, it will get to your ankle. And I just told him, I'm not that patient. It hurts right there. And then he adjusted my ankle. But it comes down to, you know, him as the doctor saw the change that he was looking to affect. But me as the patient didn't feel the change he was looking to affect. And it wasn't on my timeline. And somewhere along the way, we have been taught as patients that that makes us high maintenance and that makes us problematic or troubling to not be satisfied with the outcome. So now I'll say to my patients, I'll adjust their pelvis and I'll say, well, this looks a lot better to me. I mean, and I can say that all day, but if it doesn't feel better to you, then we're not done yet.
And patients say to me all the time, well, what do you feel? And I almost want to say to him, what do you want me to feel? What do you want me to tell you about what I feel? Do you want me to tell you you're the tightest person I ever touched? Because if you want that, I'll tell you that. Because that's almost like part of what they're paying us for is all of this nocebic type language. It's like, you know, they want to know how bad they are. And but then I say, if you want the truth, you know, there's a lot of people tighter than you that have no problems. There are a lot of people looser than you that have a lot of problems. And then I'll go into that boredom of the poor interrelator reliability of palpation to begin with. What is it really proving to us, right? But what do you want me to say? You know, so what I often will say is, well, I do feel like there could be some tightness here, but I immediately turn it around to them and I'll say, but as I touch that spot, as I stretch or whatever we're doing, what do you feel as I do that? Because I think that allows that shared decision-making. We have to start somewhere. We have clinical expertise. We've got training and all that stuff, right? But I think there's a line that clinicians should draw in not thinking that we know more than the patient because I've not lived their experience, right? And until we include them, it's going to be a one-sided conversation going on.
Well, and you bring up this whole point of needing to validate that patient experience. So if you have someone who's coming in saying, you know, and I've had this show up in my office where no one believes me, tell me I'm as bad as I think I am.
Yeah.
And that is actually, in that case, can be a really healing medicine. Yeah. I see you. You are as every bit as dysfunctional as you say right now.
Right.
Now let's move forward. Yeah. Or, you know, I'm not that bad and I need to know that I can overcome this. But that's that bias of how the brain is going to work to heal. Do I need to be validated so that I can move forward? Or do I need to know that this isn't so bad and I can overcome it to move forward? Both of those are medicine in their own way.
Yeah. A friend of mine, Brian Fulton, who's a Canadian massage therapist, wrote a book, The Placebo Effect in Manual Therapy. And he really goes into the science of placebo as it applies to the manual therapies. And from I learned a lot from Brian, including the concept of that patient who walks into my office having said, well, you know, my last therapist said I've got the worst trigger points that they've ever felt. And you just want to like reach out to the phone and strangle that last therapist, because what did they do? They set up a scenario. So the patient thinks that they are so bad, that they're the worst person that this expert has ever seen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what walks into our office sometimes. How do we clean up that mess? And mm-hmm. I don't know all the times that we can, because they even maybe that last person didn't help them, but they believed them. And finally, somebody found explanation for why I'm having so much problem. I've got the worst fill in the blank that God ever created, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, there's a lot of unpackaging, because in a way, they were almost relieved that somebody said that to them. But on the other hand, how do we deal with it? How do we separate them from that? Now, and even when their pain lessens or their function improves, there's that mm-hmm. part of their brain that little weasel just wormed its way into, that's always about, I'm so bad off. How am I going to get better? And mm-hmm. That's the stuff you and I face every day with people speaking what they think is from the best intentions or their best training, but in reality, not taking into account the patient's experience and how they're going to integrate the words that we talk about. I think that's mm-hmm. dangerous.
Yeah, it gives permission to walk away mm-hmm. in a sense. Yeah. This is the worst that ever was. Not much to do about it. I will accept that it is the worst that ever was.
Yeah. Or it becomes a sales model. Mm-hmm. It becomes a sales model. Well, you know what? I think we're going to have to set up a lot of appointments here because it's going to take a long time. And patients are so impressionable and vulnerable. I hate predatory behavior on the part of clinicians. And we do it at a lot of different levels in selling our services, selling packages to save them money and all that stuff. And while there's an aspect of it that's well-meaning and it's good for our bottom line, I also think that it sells them that, you know what, I don't know how long this is going to take, but I trust this person. And I think that's dangerous.
Yeah. I think there's a dichotomy, which we would be a whole nother rabbit hole. And I do want to circle back around some more of the practicality.
Got it. Yep.
But yeah, about, you know, health is not actually a good business, but disease absolutely is. But now just dangling that out there, we're going to take an abrupt pace, because I'm really curious to hear more as we talk about this swallowing and speech pathologies. Mm-hmm. And we understand from the context of this whole conversation that we can't just point to that one spot and say, you know, here it is. That's the origin of all pathological stuff surrounding speech. Maybe we could start with a more exploratory side of the conversation to say, for our listeners that might feel tightness, feel constriction, and haven't been able to pinpoint that spot, haven't been able to find release, what are some curiosities that we can bring to, you know, you talk about working from diaphragm on up or even pelvis on up. What are some curiosities we can engage in with ourselves as we explore how our body moves, how our throat and swallowing moves, or if that's too broad?
Yeah. I mean, are we talking about voice or pick one, right? Yeah. You know, if you're talking about a vocal disorder, whether it's a muscle tension dysphonia or performance voice fatigue, in terms of how I teach my patients self-care, self-treatment, it always follows immediately after the treatment itself. If we're doing something in the base of tongue region, where the getting some pressure up through the base of the tongue, that sort of rings that little doorbell in our brain and say, oh yeah, that's where I get that pain that happens when I talk too much, that fatigue, right? So that's the target of my intervention, is not just the tissue, but the feeling up here where they say, yeah, that's it right there, right? Mm-hmm. And then we'll linger on that point for what some people view as an inordinate amount of time, will linger for a long time. There's a cool study that, if you want to talk about it later, on why longer lingering might be effective. But, we'll linger on that until the patient begins to process that something is changing. And whether it's the local tissues that I'm changing or whether it's their descending modulation of tone or whatever, right? But then to integrate them into the process immediately. And sometimes we'll do it as a hand over hand, where I'll ask them to put their hands there and then I'll come hand over hand with them and we'll go explore for that. I use a lot of medical words in my practice, in my seminars. I call that frozen chicken, right? We're looking for something. It's like, oh, it feels tight. It's like frozen chicken. And people say, why do you call it frozen chicken? It's like, I don't want to add another pathology to your brain that already feels like you're overloaded with the things that people are wrong with you. So you've got a lump of chicken here, It may never change, but at least it's a target. Let's go poke at that frozen chicken. And to you, patient, do you feel like I'm doing something, like we're doing something effectual? And if so, what happens if you linger? So self-care is often not, again, I'll stop that, is always a continuation of the care that we do. Mm-hmm. The dosing of homework, right? That's something that you and I make up. Do it X number of times a day. Here's how you do it. Here's how many, you know, all this stuff. People expect, like, somewhere it's written, you know, in the scripture that—
You're giving away our secret.
Yeah,
we make it up.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like, when does it feel good? When does it feel helpful? Okay.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is also the concept of, well, can we do preventative care?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, that's a big can of worms. How can you— number one, how can you prove that you prevented something? That's a real tough one. But yet people, patients, clinicians expect it. You need to come for regular massages to prevent this from happening. You need to get regular adjustments. You need to exercise. You need to do these things to keep that thing from coming back. And patients, you know, they expect that from us. So, you know, if they really want to know, it's like, okay, from a prevention standpoint, does it feel helpful to you, Carly, to come into this region and see if you can give a stretch to, for instance, lower the larynx, if that feels helpful, or raise it, or somehow bring it anteriorly to give that sense of clarity in your voice. If you hold that stretch, will that stretch seem to help you over time? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about the way I teach is I believe I'm a bridge builder. I don't know the world of the speech pathologist. I don't know the world of the voice professional. I don't know the world of the chiropractor, right? But can I give you a framework, a hands-on framework to apply a patient-centered perspective, and then you take it home and you apply it to your population.
Mm-hmm.
From feedback from people who I've taught, how I hear they're applying it are just so novel and so brilliant. And it's like, I never taught you that. I love that. You know, I've got therapists, speech pathologists, as well as voice coaches working with elite level, you know, extremely well-known people, incorporating this work into their work that they're doing every day before and after a performance. And I think, how cool is that to affect that level of recognition? But how cool is it to be having an effect with that person recovering from a stroke? And that's where I think that's what really drives me to work every day and drives me to teach every day, is the ability to basically hand something to you in the middle of a bridge and say, Carly, take this home and see what you can apply, how you can apply it. Did I totally walk away from your question, by the way? I'm really good at that.
I mean, you did, but I love the journey. But what I like from that is that when you start to understand the system and the application and the personal experience of what some basic principles can affect, then you do get to be that bridge. You do get to be that conversation between specialties, mm-hmm. where foundationally, you know, we can affect change, and then how you're either going to use it in elite singing performances or in post-stroke recovery.
Right.
It doesn't have to be as pigeonholed as one might think. So you can treat any number of experiences in your office.
Yeah.
So I think that's amazing. And you know, I kind of set you up with a question that's like, you know, here's a very broad question for a very broad thing. Please give us a specific enough answer that our listeners can walk away with. And that's just kind of not fair when we're talking about the question is, how do you feel when we do this?
And
that's the baseline for all of the intervention.
And letting you decide, does it feel like it might be effective? Does it feel like it could be harmful? Or does it feel like it's a waste of time? I don't care how many times this has worked with someone else. If you are not feeling like this is doing something positive, then let's do something differently, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is challenging to clinicians, because they expect to learn what's best for a certain problem, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, I've got a whole range of things that might work, but let's let you, the patient, tell me what you think works. Mm-hmm. And a lot of patients are not, they're not equipped to handle, they're not ready to do that,
mm-hmm.
Because no one's ever tasked them with that. Or there also is that patient that for other reasons earlier in their life, they're not able to contribute in the way that I expect from them, which is why I'm a real pest as a therapist, because I keep asking questions. What are you feeling? Is that familiar? Does this feel helpful or whatever? I am a lot of work to work with. And I think a lot of, occasionally a patient leaves because they're looking for an expert who will solve their problems for them. And mm-hmm. I don't view problems as being solved by me. I think that the two of us can come up with some possible solutions, but we got to work on them together.
It feels like I start to turn into a Debbie Downer as I want to see the future of healthcare and the future of healing modalities, you know, any of the initials that we could throw behind our name to become a lot of work, to become a lot of effort on the part of the patient. And I got to say, I have gone through quite a number of modalities in my life with a whole lot of healing issues and injuries. And the ones that demand the most work of me are the ones that I have seen the most, quote unquote, miraculous responses to, mm-hmm. you know, healing handicaps like hearing impairment and brain damage that were never supposed to change.
Right.
But if I had continued to outsource them, they never would have.
Yeah.
But as soon as we start to get curious about all of the pathways in the whole system, it's not one thing. Right. I'm like 100+ pages into a book explaining how it's not one thing.
Yeah.
Because it can't be. We are so much more than that.
Yeah.
So you did bring up, so just to give as much one thing practical, man, this is such a dichotomous conversation. You did talk about the potential and the impact of long lingering on a tissue. Yeah, and I think there is a lot of value to kind of diving in there because you are, as we've talked about, affecting so many systems as you do that. So you can kind of give us a crash course there.
You know, the way I learned myofascial release back in the early 90s was about a long lingering stretch. It was about mm-hmm. what was said to be taking the fascia up to its limit, of its restricted limit, and then waiting for these various benchmarks of time for the fascia to quote unquote release. Okay. And, you know, that model was based on a lot of old osteopathic research as well as some of Ida Rolf's work. And, you know, it was sort of brought forward in a sort of like, okay, we're going to take that bit of evidence that doesn't really apply, but we're going to say it applies. Okay. And the way I learned it back in the early 90s was you had to hold it for 90 to 120 seconds. And then after I left, that model changed to 5 minutes. You have to hold it for 5 minutes. It's like, wait a minute, what was I doing for 90 to 120 seconds out of that time? But either way, I learned it in that way and it was effective. Right. And I thought I was effective because I was maintaining that stretch on a person long enough to get sufficient fascial release, right? And maybe that's part of it. But Robert Schlepp is a German Rolfer and fascial researcher who, in one of his papers from 2003, Fascial Plasticity, he talked about some known properties of Ruffini mechanoreceptor stimulation. Okay. Ruffini mechanoreceptors, well, they talk about it, how they're in the fascia, but they're also in the skin. Okay. They are slow adapting lateral skin stretch mechanoreceptors that basically, if you stretch the skin for a long period of time, it goes to the brain and basically says, brain, pay attention, something's going on down here. Okay. And one apparently from Schlepp's research and what he brought up was that there's a known diminishment of sympathetic dominance when we stretch the skin and stimulate Ruffini mechanoreceptors. So that's one possible reason why a slower prolonged stretch might be effectual. But then so
I'm going to interrupt you just
to
de-Latin, to de-jargon that, is to mostly say that a nice, sustained, calm stretch on the skin is going to help chill out your body. It's going to take you into that rest and digest. And that's the neuromechanics of pressure.
Thanks. You can be my translator up here in the corner when I talk.
Okay. I can sign a little bit of it too.
Thank you. There's a really cool paper in 2017, and I think it was in a chiropractic journal by a researcher by the last name of Saratelli. Mm-hmm. What they wanted to know was they basically set up this research project where they had a patient on a table. Okay. They had the patient's brain being monitored by however they do that. Right. And they had the clinician standing at the feet. And I think there was a boundary so the patient couldn't see the clinician. And the clinician was asked simply to touch the patient's ankle. Don't do anything. Don't think anything. Just pay attention to your touch at the ankle. Okay. And the control group was the clinician had headphones on where he or she was being blasted with random noises, which interfered with their ability to simply think lovely thoughts at the ankle. Okay. But in the test group, there were no headphones and the clinician was basically allowed to put attention into the ankle. Now, in my more alternative models that I used to train with, we call that grounding, we call that presence, we call that intent, and all those things of why it's important that we're attentive to a patient and not thinking about where we're gonna go for dinner, right? But what they showed was that in the patients where the clinician was being blessed with headphones, nothing changed in terms of what was happening to the associative centers of the brain. Okay, nothing really changed. But in the other ones that, and I'm going to paraphrase this wildly because I don't understand the whole concept to be fully blunt, but basically the associative centers opened up and became more active, which is part of why change occurs when, whether it's a touch-based intervention, behavioral-based intervention, or anything, right? That the patient's brain was adapting to the clinician's response. But what was really cool was it peaked at 15 minutes. And then it started to diminish. So basically those gates open the longer we touch, and then they finally just close back down and say, okay, maybe I've had enough. Now, am I cherry picking pieces of that study? Absolutely, right? But to me, that's at least some recognition that that sustained attention and sustained touch may have not better effect than quicker touch, but maybe a different sort of effect on the patient and their responses, not just at the tissue, but up here at the brain.
And this is what I love about body work and healing is that we can dive so deep. We can say touch on the skin that's creating heat, friction, whatever, sustains touch. Now we're dealing with Ruffini cells, or we're going deeper and faster, and we got Puccini cells that are more vigorously stimulated. And either of those will go to our nervous system, either upregulating or downregulating, and that's going to go to our blood flow and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yep. And then inside of all of that is this approach to health and healing that boils down to some aspects of quantum physics, where we are energy and the clinician is energy. And this is now a shared energetic field in which we are engaging. And whatever modality you're in, you know, I learned grounding, I learned presencing, I learned polarity therapy and Reiki, which is going to use more of those energetic chakra models, but all of it is about how are you presencing yourself to this person, to this patient and client, and what are you creating together?
Right, right. Again, I told you I was sarcastic and cynical. You know, I learned the Kumbaya model too, in terms of it's all about, you know, you need to have your presence and on. There was something that was unsatisfying about that to me, because it allowed so much room for interpretation. And not to take off what you said before, but people use that we're all connected model way too extreme. It becomes a way to explain everything and not have to work harder for a real answer. What I like about this study, for instance, is it takes the Kumbaya model of, you know, yes, let's all be part of this that I kind of learn, and to some people they really enjoy that. But to me, that study puts into perspective how the evidence can explain some of our outcomes. And to me, there was, talk about circling back, right? It really can. We can use that evidence to support why we get outcomes from certain interventions, at least from a part of it. It doesn't explain the whole thing.
Right.
We don't know the whole thing.
Well, and that's really what it highlights. And what I think becomes the trap of conversation is that in wanting to highlight perhaps a modality or an approach to care, a thinking of care that isn't often taught and expanded upon, you know, might be more of the alternative world of, you know, this whole patient-centered thing, whose idea was that? It starts to turn into this dichotomous idea of this is now what the model needs to be. This is everything. When the truth of it is, it is not one or the other. It is both in its correct dosing for that person.
Yeah.
It is the stuck joint and the bound up tissue, and it's the whole body and the way the patient or the client thinks they can heal and the way the practitioner thinks that they can intervene. Yeah. It is all. And when we start to get dogmatic about one versus the other, that's when we really start to lose out on a lot of potential and a lot of growth.
Right. I look at the concept of posture as like that. I learned a posture model of myofascial release in my physical therapy training. It's like, okay, look at a person's posture and you can almost diagnose why they're having that problem. And I saw the benefit from that, but I see the flaws in that too. And I don't do much quote unquote posture work anymore. I used to stand everybody up and, you know, I'd just be like writing stuff down and basically making them feel even worse about their posture. And then I stopped caring about posture so much because I realized that it was only part of a larger whole, right? Mm-hmm. So when do I look at posture? I look at posture if my patient thinks it's important, right? I can pull those pieces out, whether it's evaluation or treatment. And I don't want to sound like I'm trying to be a people pleaser or doing, you know, like being disingenuous about their posture. But if you feel your posture is important, let's address it together. And, you know, I'm not going to correct it and make you stay, you know, like that forever. That's unrealistic. But if posture is a part of it, let's incorporate it into the larger whole of what we're doing.
Okay? Because you so often can apply, just like we were talking about before, you know, what is this unique thing, this foundational thing? Does this help? And you can apply it to, you know, stroke recovery or elite singing. But we can also say you feel your posture is amok. Okay, do thing A. Does that help with your posture in the way that's important to you? Okay, you feel like your walking is amok. Okay, do thing A. Does that help with your walking in the way that's important to you? We're going to use your outcome and your needs as part of the care.
Yeah. And when it comes to, for instance, voice or swallowing, there's a fair amount of evidence in papers talking about using posture as a tool in dysfunctional voice, dysfunctional swallow, and then doing postural intervention and the person swallows better or speaks better. But first of all, there is no such thing as just working on a person's posture, right? You're working, how did you get there? Was it strengthening? Was it stretching? Was it behavioral modification? Was it, you know, rigid reinforcement? Whatever that was, there's no such thing as a single silo type of intervention, right? Mm-hmm. And what is also missing from that evidence is there's a lot of people with really lousy posture that swallow and speak just fine, right? And there's a lot of people with horrible forward head that don't have neck pain. But yet, if you and I follow those memes that we see all the time, that, oh, you're just a time bomb waiting to happen, I'm sorry, but the evidence doesn't support that. You know, the predictive model of posture is a future predictor of issues. That's pretty thin, that sort of evidence. Sure, we do something to get them to be more erect, and they swallow, they speak, they turn their head, they're more happier, right? But you don't overplay that hand and think that everybody has to be here to be a decent human being, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I say a lot in my office, it only matters if it matters.
I like that. Yeah. I like that a lot.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing fun. All of your experience. Yeah. And to our listeners, I do hope that we want to talk about swallowing and voice. And I think you kind of have to listen through the experience to get this idea that, yes, what's happening in your throat and your diaphragm is really important. There's a lot of techniques that we can work on here, but this also becomes a conversation for any niche type of care, which is, can we look more broadly and can we be curious about our experience and own that information? So hoping you don't feel like I gave you a bait and switch here. I'll blame Walt. I hope Walt didn't give you a bait and switch. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. You've got a lot of stuff that you are working on. Can you tell our listeners where they can find you, what's coming up for you?
Yeah. The one of the easiest ways is my website, waltfritz.com. That's probably the fastest way to catch up on all this. I have a newsletter from the bottom of every page of the website. I teach regularly. I teach 2 to 3 times a month around the country, around the world. Now the COVID's kind of, we'll see what happens. But I teach a lot to that voice and swallowing audience, but I get a lot of broader clinicians coming to that. I also teach another class or two. We've got some UK classes coming up in March on upper body, lower body, and voice, the whole thing. But you can find my class listings there. You can find I'll be putting this podcast, but a lot of other podcasts that I've done with a lot of people from a lot of different perspectives, voice, swallowing, massage, fitness, exercise. There's a cool conversation I did with the philosopher from the University of Denmark who wrote that book on, who edited that book on the this the unique patient called the Cause Health blog. Anyway, it's there. Lots of good stuff. What else did you? Oh, and I got a book. Hopefully the book will be out. The manuscript is in, and hopefully the book will be out at the early part of next year. The title is Manual Therapy and Voice and Swallowing, A Person-Centered Perspective. And while it sounds very niche-y, and it is, the concepts I think apply to all of us. And I don't want to be everything to everybody, but the concepts of how we apply within the narrow context of voice and swallow apply throughout. And I don't care whether you're using manual therapy or an exercise-based approach or behavioral-based approach, looking at the person not as as a tissue in distress, but a person in distress. I think that's the kind of the take home from the book. And I'm pretty active on social media. I got a big mouth and I like to kind of blow it off a lot. So you can find me all over different platforms as well. I appreciate, Carly, the time that you took today. You're a great interviewer and I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. I enjoyed this conversation very much. I love this. This really is, as I think our listeners now well know, that when we get into systems and we get into this interconnected place and that very human-centered approach, that's where it's hard for me to wind down the conversation and keep the podcast to a reasonable commute. So thank you so much for joining. It was really a highlight of my day. And to all of our listeners, please do check out Walt and his work. We will have his website linked in the show notes below. And maybe this will change your way of how you interact with your clinicians and your providers, own a little bit more of your experience and bring that to the treatment table, whatever form that takes for you. In the meantime, have a wonderful week. We'll be back next Monday with another episode of Healing Ground Movement Podcast. Be well.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help.